with any sect, denomination, politics, organisation or institution, does not wish to engage in any controversy, neither endorses nor opposes any causes. Our primary purpose is to stay sober and help other alcoholics to achieve sobriety.
Thanks a lot, Thomas. Okay, so we've got two speakers now, and then we're going to have a short break, and then James is going to come up. Our first speaker I'd like to introduce is Sylvie from Adbury Sunday Just For Today meeting. The first Alzheimer's she came across was Barry of Oxford, and the first meeting she attended was Cambridge. So with that, I'm going to hand it over to you, Sylvie.
Thank you. Hello, friends, known and unknown. My name's Sylvie, and I'm an alcoholic.
Hi, Sylvie.
When I came this morning and I was sitting over there, I found it very difficult to hear, but I don't have very good hearing. So if you can't hear me, you'll probably have to either move forward or I'll have to shout. If you can't hear, let me know, but I'll try and be as clear as I can. My drinking story is absolutely dead boring. So I'm hoping to talk more about recovery. However, I must tell you how I got here in the first place. I say it's dead boring because when I first came in, I hoed the most dramatic chairs you could imagine, which caused me to look for all the differences. So if yours is dramatic and you can't identify with mine, which isn't, please don't do what I did, because I gave myself a lot of extra grief. I better start quickly. I better start first. When I say it's not dramatic, it sounds funny, because being in the process of killing yourself is dramatic enough, but there are ways and ways of doing it. When I say it's not dramatic, it's because I didn't go into prison, I didn't go into hospital, I wasn't even in a police cell, and I never peed in a wardrobe. So I reckon, I'm not quite sure whether I qualify as being a proper alcoholic, but all I know is that it was making my life an absolute misery. My parents, my mother was Swiss and my father was English, and they met on a ship going to New Zealand, which is possibly why I was born with a travel bug in my bones and became a travel writer and did a lot of travelling, which introduced me to a lot of cheap booze around the world. I learnt subsequently that my father was a teetotaler because his father was an alcoholic. I wished I'd known much earlier, because by the time it was of any significance to me, he wasn't there to ask. I don't know whether he would have told me. All I do know is it must have affected his life tremendously, because having gone to New Zealand on a business trip, because he worked in the city for a career I know not what for, when he got back, he was so concerned about his father's drinking and the way he was treating my grandmother that he gave up whatever career he was going for and opened a shop in the suburbs of London so he could put his father in it and go into it himself and keep an eye on him. So it obviously made an enormous difference, but by the time all this became clear to me, I was not in a state to really follow it through, and there ain't nobody left who can enlighten me. So I didn't actually meet alcohol till my late teens. As you can see, I'm an old timer in every sense of the word, and my childhood was at the end of World War II. This meant that we had excitement built into our daily life, and we didn't have to go out and search for it. So when I hear about the young people now doing all sorts of strange things, I'm quite grateful that I did have a childhood in the Second World War, because we had air raids and all sorts of things going on, and we didn't really have time to think about getting up to a lot of mischief. We had quite a lot of air raids, and I fortunately felt completely indestructible. So I wasn't, at least I wasn't consciously afraid. Subsequently, when I talked to people about being a depressive, they said it may have affected me without me even knowing it, but I'm not going to go into that. When the war ended, at that time, unlike now, when young people kind of seem to assume they're going to university, this wasn't an assumption. And in fact, in my arrogance, I wanted to be a writer, and therefore all I wanted to do was go and get some experience in order to be able to do that. So, in fact, I had the cheek when I was 12 to write to Richard Dimbleby, some of you may have heard of him, and you've probably heard of his sons. And he was quite remarkable. He ran some newspapers at the time, and he wrote me back in his own fair hand and told me what to do. And a few years ago, any questions came to the village where I lived then, in Deddington, Oxfordshire. And I took this letter from Richard Dimbleby, because I'm a hoarder, so I still had it. And Jonathan Dimbleby, or David, I can't remember which it is, looked at it and said, oh, that's my father's writing, which I thought 50 or 60 years later was quite remarkable. And he read it and he said, I wonder if somebody of my father's stature would go to the trouble now of writing to a 12-year-old. I suspect not, but maybe. Anyway, he told me to get shorthand and typing, which I doubt if many people do. Well, they'll be computing nowadays. I don't know how many people learn shorthand, but I still use it, and very useful it is. So when I die, nobody will be able to read anything. But never mind, it'll go in the dustbin like a lot of other stuff. But I can still read 90% of it. And I got a job. He then said, get shorthand typing, get yourself a job on a local paper, because the war was seemingly coming to an end by then. And when you've done that and got some experience, write to me again. Well, the war ended, and I got my exams, which was then matriculation. It's completely different now. And I went to the local tech and did shorthand and typing, and then I went to the local papers and asked for a job. Well, I should think they took one look at me and thought, no way. I was 17, extremely green and inexperienced, and I hadn't had a drink. And the boys were coming back from the forces. There was a shortage of paper, and about the last thing they were going to do was give a job to someone as inexperienced as me. So fortunately, I say fortunately because I'd have been useless, I didn't get a job, but I got a job on a little agricultural magazine in London, run by an organisation called the Country Gentlemen's Association, which gives you an idea of what sort of organisation it was. And they published a monthly magazine called the Estate Magazine, and I was secretary to the editor, who taught me everything he knew and then said, now go and get yourself a better job. While I was working for this gentleman, a girl who was in the same office as me, called Sally, I became very friendly with, and her folks ran a pub in a village near St. Neots in Huntingdonshire. And in due course, I went with Sally and stayed in the pub. And I had this curiosity about alcohol. I mean, why didn't Dad drink? I didn't know. What was so evil about it? I didn't know. So when Sally, who did drink, said, why don't you have a sherry? I had nine and was very sick. And I found if you were sick, you felt better and you could drink some more. So with this sparse knowledge, I built up. And I found, the thing I found was, of course, was that I was very shy. I found it difficult to get on with the big world outside. And here I was able suddenly to say witty things and clever things, I thought. And I went home. Now, obviously, I wasn't going to bring alcohol into the house because in my young day, you kind of didn't do that sort of thing. I changed my job and I got a job with a firm that specialised in public relations. Public relations was very, very new then. Now everybody's doing it. But at that time, we were just beginning to realise that this is what you did. You sold your services to try and persuade people to either use a service or buy something that they didn't know they wanted. And I had a... My bosses then were dealing with various people, and we had press parties to sell these things. And we had people coming from Fleet Street. And of course, when you're shy, what do you do when you're going to meet journalists from Fleet Street? So I got onto gin, I think, at that stage. But my head was quite good by then. And so I learnt to make the most of it. And it wasn't doing me any harm. I wasn't drinking at home because the situation was still the same. And I just thought it was a wonderful friend. And so it was. Cunning, baffling, powerful, wonderful friend. It made me able to cope with my own inadequacies, which were many. I stayed with this firm for a while, and then it was while I was with them, they were in London, that I joined an organisation which specialised for in women writers. And we used to meet once a month, and we had an editor would come and read our stories and give us her or his or her opinion. And on one occasion, I put forward one of my stories because I'd written as a child during the war, and I carried on writing. In fact, during the war, I wrote endless stories, and I didn't have the faintest idea how you got published, but I even wrote my own book reviews because I thought that's what you did. And I went to this meeting and I brought this story, which was a romance, and it was a magazine called Heiress, which no longer exists, but was the successor to something called Girls on Paper. And the woman read this story and she said, "This is a remarkable story showing great insight into the teenage mind." Well, as I was 18, it was hardly surprising. And I was offered 18 guineas, and I didn't know so much. For those of you who don't know, a guinea is £1.01, which is now £1.10. And 18 guineas was £18.90, I think. And I thought that I didn't know such money existed. I mean, it was about four times the weekly salary I was getting at the time. Probably get that per hour now, I don't know. And it was published, and that was my first story actually in print. And I bought a bicycle with the 18 guineas, which I called Ulysses. So that was the beginning of my writing career, and thus encouraged I carried on. And when I joined the public relations firm, one of my bosses wrote plays, he had an agent, and in those days it wasn't that difficult as it is now, and this guy took me on, and it was wonderful. He used to send my stories out to various women's magazines, and he'd ring me up and say, would Miss Nichols be happy to accept 15 guineas or 20 guineas or whatever guineas it happened to be? And of course Miss Nichols always was, and I would accept it, and we'd all go out and have a drink. I think I got back to sherry at that point. And that was the introduction to alcohol. And then I got on to a travel magazine, and that I suppose is when the rot started to set in, because I began to get the opportunities to travel abroad. And the more I was travelling abroad, the more independent I became in my way of life, the more I needed alcohol to help me cope with it. One of the first countries I visited was Finland. Now, that had an early history in my childhood, because I doubt if many of you will remember, but during the Second World War, when Russia was our ally, Russia was at war with Finland, which kind of made Finland our enemy, though it never was. And I used to look at the map of Finland and Russia in the Daily Telegraph and say, but it's not fair, because Finland was about this size and Russia was about this size. And that was my first knowledge of Finland. While I was on the travel magazine, my boss said to me, what are you doing next weekend, Sylvie? I said, nothing, as far as I know. He said, I want you to go to Finland for me. It appeared that he had accepted a visit to Finland, an invitation, but in the meantime he'd had another invitation to go to Rome, and I think he thought Rome might be more interesting and warmer, so he asked me to go to Finland. I went to Finland, and there began a love affair that still continues, not with a human being, but with a country. I did fall for a Finn, but he kind of moved out of my life fairly rapidly. I love Finland. I love the fact that it had proper seasons. It had real, real winters. It had real, real summers that went on for 24 hours. It had autumn with brilliant colours. It had spring when ice melted and things happened very quickly. And I loved it. And when I got fed up with being overworked and underpaid on this magazine, I decided I would get a job in Finland. And I wanted to go, I mean, I alcoholically wanted to go to extremes. I didn't want a job in Finland. I wanted a job north of the Arctic Circle in Finland. And I finally got one as a teacher of English to the staff of hotels in return for board and lodging and pocket money. And I went up there for the best part of a year, and I loved it. And then I wrote a short, I wrote a book for children on Finland. At that time, life really was easier. You could get published, not easily, but much more easily than now. And you could get jobs more easily than now. In fact, you know, if you got fed up with your job, you gave up and you chose another one. And I don't somehow think it's quite that easy. Also, you didn't have contracts and things. So I worked in Finland for nearly a year. I wrote a children's book. And one day I had a letter which said, Dear Miss Nichols, you will see from my notepaper that I am a lecturer. At the moment I'm preparing a lecture on Northern Europe or Northern Scandinavia. I know Norway and Sweden, but I don't know Finland, and I understand from the Finnish Tourist Office that you have just spent best part of a year there, and I'd be very grateful for your help. And it was signed by someone called George Spenceley, and I married him 15 years later. So Finland kind of has a rather special place in my life. After we'd corresponded for a bit, we met up. He lived in Yorkshire, I still lived in the suburbs of London. We had lunch together, and he was, of course, already married, you know, inevitably. He'd come straight out of World War II and Bomber Command. He'd been shot down, fractured his skull, was the sole survivor of an air crash, was healed sufficiently to put him in a prisoner of war camp for 3 years, came out and married the first woman he met, which wasn't a brilliant idea. But however, he had, and although he wanted to make... I mean, I didn't particularly want to get married. I enjoyed my travelling life. I wanted to carry on with my writing career. But George had by then, by the time I met him, he had three sons, and he always said that he wouldn't leave home until they were all grown up. So that's why it took 15 years. I'm not proud of that, but you know, it happened, and it's very much part of my story. So eventually, my father died when I was in my mid-30s. My sister, who had married and got two children, had moved to Cambridge. So my mother and I moved to Cambridge so that my sister would be near my mother while I was travelling. By this time, I've forgotten, I always get things mixed up. I'd come back from Finland. The magazine I was writing for, which was called Go, had gone. It had become taken over by a very rich young man, and we hated each other on sight. So I started doing something that was probably fairly precarious even then. I started to become a freelance writer, and that I stayed and remained until today, and believe it or not, I'm still scribbling. I lived at home for a while. When Mum and I moved to Cambridge, I carried on writing. George, by then, had already met my parents, and he came to visit us in Cambridge. He lived in Yorkshire. He was a full-time geography teacher, but did his lecturing during his spare time, and in the process, he was a mountaineer. Fortunately, he did not expect me to hang by my fingernails off a rock face. But he, curiously enough, wanted me to watch him doing it, and I refused. But we had a lot in common, quite apart from Finland. He'd had the war experience rather more than me, but, you know, he had this great feeling for humanity. And he'd travelled, he'd been to the Himalayas, he'd been to the Antarctic, he'd been to the Arctic, he'd been all over the shop. And we started travelling together. He was doing lectures on East Europe, so I got onto a travel guide team and started doing revisions of books for guidebooks on East Europe. And we camped. We did everything the hard way. And it was the hard way because George did not believe that a tent was a tent unless you crawled into it. He had nothing to do with these things you stood up in. So we crawled into tents all over Europe and eventually all over a lot of other countries as well. And eventually the situation became such that the boys were grown up and we decided to make our lives together. And he moved from Yorkshire and I moved from Cambridge and we put a pin in the map and we ended up in North Oxfordshire in a village called then Steeple-Aston, and then we moved to Deddington. We had, although I was about 45 by this time, we had 37 absolutely wonderful years of marriage and partnership in which we travelled the world and did a huge amount of things together. I should just mention, actually, because by then, I've forgotten AA and all this, haven't I? which is rather basic. When we moved to, when I was in Cambridge, my drinking, especially after my mother moved in with my sister, became really drastic by my standards. I could never have drunk what some of you have described that you drank, because I would have been dead long, long ago. The effect it had me was not on my body but on my mind, and because I was depressive, I was getting more and more anxious, more and more frightened, needed more and more alcohol to make me less and less frightened, and trying to find the right level for a long time, and I couldn't because it had got me in its grip by then. And at one point, George was worrying because he used to bring alcohol, and he realised that when he left me, he stopped and I carried on. And he used to try and suggest that, perish the thought, if I carried on, I might have to stop altogether. So I started lying, He used to ring me at 7 and I prayed that he wouldn't be late, so I wouldn't open the bottle until, wine it was by then, I wouldn't open the bottle until he'd rung, so I could honestly say I was not at that moment drinking, forgetting the bottle I'd already had. And eventually I realised that I was beaten and that there is this thing called Alcoholics Anonymous, and it was to do with people who drank too much, and if I went to see them, just possibly I might be able to, I wasn't listening of course, just possibly I might be able to get it under control. And when the inevitable happened, and I'd promised George if I carry on with what he called my solo drinking, I would get and do something about it, and the inevitable happened, I picked up the phone into Cambridge, in Cambridge then. There was no AA in the telephone book. I can't quite remember how it was, but there were individual names under Alcoholics Anonymous, and one of the individual names, whose name, alas, I can't remember now, I rang. And I told him I was worried about my drinking. And to my astonishment, he told me all about himself. I thought, what an extraordinary thing to do. But the main thing was that he wasn't drinking. Now, at that time, there was only one meeting in Cambridge. And he said, I can't meet you because I live too far away, but I could get someone from something called Al-Anon, whatever that was, to meet you outside. So I thanked him very much. And then he said, by the way, he said, are you on the program? You sound as though you are. And he was such a nice man, and he obviously wanted me to be on whatever the program was. So I said, yes, I was. So I was a very muddled lady. I went to my first meeting. You couldn't see across the room for smoke. I thought, thank God I can smoke. There was a lady called Joyce. I liked the look of her. And she bade me welcome. And she said, you don't have to speak. So I sat down and I listened to this chair. And it was fantastic. He'd been all over the place. His marriage had broken up. He'd been to hospital. Don't think he'd been to prison, but he'd certainly been in police cells. I don't think they talked about peeing in wardrobes in those days. I thought, that's wonderful. But of course I didn't identify. Hadn't done any of those things. But I enjoyed the story. So I carried on going to the meetings so I could go to the, listen to the stories. And this is not a way to get sober. However, I told George I'd gone to AA. He was thrilled. I used to go to London quite a lot, so I went to one or two lunchtime meetings. And everybody was delighted because I was doing this, but I was still going for the wrong reasons. And then I felt ashamed. Because I was going to meetings, because I was worried, and because it's cunning, baffling, and powerful, I was drinking very much less. And I thought, well, I haven't had a drink for a week. I can't be an alcoholic. Didn't know about bouters, of course. So I stopped going because I was ashamed. And then George said that the circumstances had changed. The boys were grown up. The youngest one was at university. The eldest one was 10 or 12 years older, and we could make our lives, and we put a pin in the map and we came to Steeple Aston. Now, another example of my non-sobriety was when we came to, I thought it's different living with somebody who's drinking than just living away from them. So I thought I'd better go back to AA. And I got the Where to Find for Oxfordshire. Or maybe it was SMIG. I wouldn't have known what SMIG was in those days. That's South Midlands Intergroup for anyone who doesn't know. And I looked at the meetings. There were two in Oxford. And there was one in Banbury. And this arrogant so-and-so thought that the Oxford meeting sounded more intellectual. So I decided to go to Oxford. I went to Oxford, and it used to be in Norham Gardens. You remember that, don't you? And my first meeting, as I came out, somebody ran after me, and it was Irish Anne. And it was her husband, who is the Barry, who I regard as my first old-timer, because at that stage, Anne wouldn't have called herself an old-timer. And said, in case you want my telephone number, here it is. And that was my first experience of someone saying, here's my telephone number. I still felt ashamed, because I wasn't going very often. And I wasn't drinking, I was having sips, because I didn't think that counted. And I was writing about travel, so I really needed to know what this wine tasted like, because how could I write about it if I hadn't sipped it? So you can justify anything, really. And that first year, we hadn't realised it, but it was a year that George was going away on a potentially quite risky trip with a mountaineering friend who had introduced him in middle age, because he was 9 years older than me, to long-distance canoeing. And they were going up to the Barren Lands of Canada to canoe across a wilderness river away from all humanity. And this was my first summer, and if those of you who've been around a while can remember, 1976 was about the hottest summer that we've had. Maybe still, I don't know. And there I was in a new town and a new home, and off he went. And I was in a terrible state because I was still doing my sipping, I was still frightened, I still got the depression. I was in a house I didn't know, in a neighbourhood I didn't know. I hated the heat. We planted a lawn and it wouldn't grow because there was no rain. And so I asked for help, I think probably for the first time. And someone called Alec, who was something to do with television aerials, came from Oxford, and I hadn't eaten for 2 days, and he made me eat a raw egg. And then he said, we're going to go to a meeting, and he said, I'm going to take you to Banbury. And he took me to Banbury, and it became my home group. It isn't at the moment, but that's another story. But it became my home group, and someone called Judy, who had been 6 years sober, and who I thought, how could anyone be 6 years sober, was the person I used as a sponsor without knowing it. I used to ring her up and we'd have long chats. And I built up very slowly from there. When George came back, oh, there was something else major that happened that summer. I was writing, still writing, and I was going to, I was going on a press trip to Mallorca and staying in a very posh hotel, because if you went on a press trip, you stayed in very posh hotels, which made a great contrast with crawling into a tent. And I stayed in this hotel, and I got into the hotel, and I hadn't been in my room for 10 minutes when there was a knock on the door, and a waiter came in with a container full of ice and a bottle of wine. And I looked at it, and it looked at me, and he put it down, and I thought, oh my God. Now, I suppose something had happened to me during that time. I picked up the phone and I said to the person who didn't speak very much English, could you please get someone to remove this bottle of wine? And in due course, the wine waiter came up with a bottle opener. And just before he could open it, I managed to get him to understand that I didn't want it opened. I wanted him to take the bottle opener and the bottle away. And I think that I can honestly say that is the first time I consciously made a decision not to have a drink on an occasion when I could have done and nobody would have known except me. And maybe nobody would have known except me was the important thing that finally registered with me. And I built up from that. I went back to AA. I mean, I was going to AA. George, fortunately, like my AA friends, couldn't understand why on earth it was that I could stop drinking with them, but not with him. But I mean, he was an old drinking partner, for God's sake. And he carried on as always, and I decided I would switch. We still went to pubs. I would drink ginger ale. God knows why, because I don't like ginger ale, but I drank ginger ale. And he got into the habit of going up and ordering my ginger ale. And I resented this enormously. And I discussed it with my friend Joyce. And she said, just tell him, will he please ask you what you want? I couldn't understand why it was so important, but I did. And he couldn't understand why it was so important, but he did. And he'd say, what do you want to drink? And I'd say, ginger ale, and he'd go and order it. Now, they're clever, these AAs, because I stopped resenting him. And it was such a small, small, simple thing. And we built up from that. And because I was now serious, I started thinking about the steps. I didn't think about a sponsor, which was very stupid. But eventually, after I'd done, I thought I'd done one and two, I realised how difficult three was going to be for me. Because before I started drinking, before I did anything, I'd made a sort of intellectual decision that the whole question of whether there was a God or not was quite important. But I didn't have time to think about it, so I'd wait till I got time and then I'd give it my full consideration. I went with George to Portugal. We were in a hotel with a bar. He was living it up and having a wonderful time. And I was so frightened because I so wanted to be there living it up with him. Now, the little 24-hour book, which don't see around as much as you're used to, was my little Bible at that stage. And I brought it with me. I hadn't read it, of course. It was in our room. So I went up to our room. I read 10 days' worth of the 24-hour-a-day book. And then I burst into tears. And then I said, I don't know who the hell or where the hell or what the hell there is out there, or if there's anything, but if there is, please take away this craving. And the craving went. It didn't go forever, but it went at that particular important moment. And I thought, oh, is that what they mean when they say hand it over? And that has been my higher power ever since. It's very abstract. I have learnt in time with the steps, and especially step 11, that if only I can get me out of the middle of the picture, then I will possibly be okay. And occasionally I can do it. There was an occasion about a month ago, when I was doing a talk, not an AA talk, but a professional talk, to quite a big audience. And I'm really quite frightened of talking. I mean, you all frighten me to death. And I thought, oh, Lord, I've got to give this talk. But it was professional. I was being paid for it, and I was going to sell some of my books. And somehow during the day, I must have managed to do a handover. Maybe it's become a bit more ingrained. But I did the talk, and I talked for much longer than I usually do. And I wasn't frightened, and I sold a load of books, and they said they'd never known the audience be so quiet. So I thought, it does work if you work it. The trouble is, it doesn't work like that. You've got to practice. And that's where I went wrong. I thought that if I just handed over, you know, in 5 minutes, everything would be all right. So I've built up on that. We continued to travel. We bought a camper van. We did all sorts of trips around Europe. And having done his canoe trip, I'd said to George, you know, next time you go, I'm coming with you, but I can't do the sort of wilderness trip you're doing. So we canoed. I took up canoeing in middle age, and we canoed the full length of the Danube, which then was through Europe, which was divided, east and west. And we had a police military escort going from Austria to what was then Czechoslovakia, and so forth. So, and then we'd done that, and he said, well, what about done the longest river in Europe? How about doing the Mississippi? So we did the Mississippi. That's why I say my recovery has been rather more interesting than my drinking. I could never, ever have done, I mean, I couldn't have done it without George, but I could never have done it with George if I'd been drinking. And I wrote a book about it, and I started talking about it, and I went back to fiction, which is my first love, and I've done some novels. And these are all things beyond my wildest dreams. I've never made much money, but I've had a good life. So then we came to the time which... going on a bit. Then we came to the time when George, who was 9 years older than me, was suddenly developed some physical problems which didn't sit kindly with an ex-mountaineer. He had a thing called polymyalgia rheumatica, which meant that he couldn't do an awful lot of walking and so forth. Then he had a pulmonary embolism. Then he had a bit of a heart quiver, and so forth. And it was clear that, you know, he wasn't going to go on forever. And then he started dementia, and that was tough because he could remember the war, he could remember every mountain he'd been on to the last rock, but he couldn't remember what he'd had for supper. And if any of you have got relatives with dementia, it's quite tiring to live with. Fortunately for him, though not for me, it didn't go on for very long because I'd finally persuaded him that we couldn't go on living in the outskirts of a village when he couldn't walk. So we decided to get a flat in the middle of the village, which was Deddington by then. And we got our solicitor to come over and bring all the papers to put our house on the market. And the solicitor left at 7:30, and George dropped dead at 8:00. And I thought, I was stricken, but eventually I thought, I guess you're trying to tell me something. And from that moment, I moved anyway, because what are you going to do with a 4-bedroom house by yourself? And I moved into a flat in Deddington, and 18 months ago, I moved into Banbury itself. It was a very, very tough time. We'd had a particularly close relationship. I'd eventually won round the only stepson who would have nothing to do with me. But once George died, there was a wretched contest over his will, which didn't help. And only one of them speaks to me now, and that's their problem now, not mine, but it was my problem for quite a while. And I started going to more meetings because, you know, without a family, my sister's children are both in Australia, and there just ain't no relatives over here. So I adopted AA, and I have informed every meeting that they now have an elderly relative, whether they like it or not. So you're all lumbered. And one of the lovely things has been that, in particular in this last 18 months, maybe because I've been going to more meetings, maybe because I've been more open to it, I've acquired some younger friends in the fellowship, some of whom, bless their hearts, treat me like a batty old aunt, which is very good for me. And I go and visit their families, and I'm so grateful. And I haven't said much about the steps, but you'll have to take it as read that I have done them. I would say this, though, and I think this is very important. that you just don't do them. They go on. When life happens, it happens in a variety of ways. And until you've been through bereavement, until you've been through financial insecurity, until you've been through all the various things that life can throw at you, you need to carry on doing the steps, because when you do them at one stage in your sobriety, you haven't been through some of this stuff and you need to go through it. I've found service essential. Because I'm not very good at putting myself forward, I had to be bulldozed into it. I was bulldozed into being secretary of the Banbury Group. I did it all wrong. I felt completely responsible whether the meeting was a success or a failure. I didn't realise that it was actually up to all of us, that if the speaker didn't turn up, it wasn't my fault. And if they weren't very good, it wasn't my fault either. Or if all the responses weren't very good, it wasn't my fault. And once I learnt to relax with this, and then I got into intergroup, and they drive me mad sometimes, especially now because we're getting so many groups, there aren't enough people to run them all, but that's another story. And eventually I got onto briefly to region, and then had the huge privilege of going to the conference in York. No, it wasn't York then, it was Liverpool, I think. Anyway, wherever it was. And I was hugely impressed by the democracy of conference. So there we are. Oh, the other thing that I learned to do is in bereavement, and you can do this when you're way into your 80s, because George was a great one for giving hugs. Out of the blue, in the middle of the day, he'd say, "We haven't had a hug today," and we'd have a hug. So now I demand hugs from all the men and the women in the groups. Thank you. I think I better shut up after that. Thank you for listening and being so patient.
Thank you so much.